you for a moment? At present I'm bored and I need someone to talk to, and you people back there on Earth are such good listeners. It can't hurt you to listen, can it? People think it must be fun to be the master. Oh, I find fun where I can, but being trapped in a burnt, decaying husk is no fun, believe me. You look at all those strong, healthy bodies passing by and you think, I want a piece of that, even though they aren't generally worthy of hosting me. Never elegant or charming enough. It's more difficult to find the right body than you think. You have only to say, would your body suit me, do you think? Then people run away for some reason. Or something annoying happens, like the arrival of the doctor. You end up feeling discontent with everything and just a bit violent and angry underneath. It's easy to blame your parents. You should have seen my mum and dad on Gallifrey. But what's the point? You just want to smash everything up. And actually, that's where the real fun begins. You've got to have a laugh, after all, or you go insane. And it's important not to go insane. No one had better call me insane. If you're going to smash everything up, you might as well do it on a grand scale. And to do that, you've got to exercise a bit of power, I've found. Of course, it's easy enough to frighten people looking like I do. People might be looking at the dressing gown hanging on the bedroom door in the dark and not realize at first that I'm hanging inside it. They may leap out of bed and find my skeletal hand is on the doorknob before their hand can reach it. All good fun, you might think. But such games are surely for children. To do something really scary, you need real power. Are you still listening? One of the problems I've found is that power decays. You can rule a galaxy for a generation or two, but then people lose interest in being tortured, or the doctor turns up and it all changes. Things change all the time, so it's hard to hold on to power, even for as little as 1,000 years. And as a Time Lord, you already know it's all going to go wrong in the end, so it takes all the fun out of it. Be assured, being able to visit the future as well as the past takes all the interest out of the present. So you might say, why don't you choose a moment when you're ruling a star system? Forget the future, just enjoy the really nasty things you're doing, and then, as soon as it even starts to go wrong, pop into your TARDIS and start the good bit again. Like choosing the best bits in one of your downloads and running them over and over again. Well, of course, that's generally what I do. As soon as the doctor turns up, unless I've got a really good chance of killing him, I do my best to escape and go back to the beginning of that bit. But the doctor's got wise to this and generally chases me back to the beginning of the bit that I like and spoils it for me, so I have to move sideways to a different galaxy and start again from scratch. It raises a big question. Why do the goodies, as their tiresome self-reference has it, always have to win? It really isn't fair. Who constructed this universe so the good things always triumph in the end? That's not to say there isn't lots of lovely dark energy in the universe. 70%, in fact, and dark matter, and no end of black holes swallowing up the light, and I'm very happy about that. But why do all the interesting things happen around the stars and in the light? That's where the complicated life forms develop. The cloud hangers of Galaxy 357, the luminescent sea squids of Nebula 9, the light-seeking seed pod intelligences of interplanetary travel. Oh, you know the sort of thing. You people on Earth have probably watched that insufferable David Attenborough going on about the wonderful diversity of life. Who'll speak up for uniformity? What about a galaxy reserved for multiplying clones of me? Now, there's a good idea. Though I've a nasty feeling I will already try that. Oh, how unhelpful language becomes when discussing time travel. And it always seems to fail in the end. As I say, it isn't fair. The good thing I find, or I suppose from my point of view the really good bad thing, is that creation takes a long time to build up, whereas destruction can be really fast. I think of the way children take a long time to build a tower of bricks, but it's so much quicker to knock it over. That's my idea of satisfying, especially if the child was just about to balance the last possible brick on top. The record number of bricks in a tower. Stamp, stamp, very fast, lots of tears, lots of fun. Rome wasn't built in a day, but it certainly can be flattened in one. I know. I've done it. The other thing that helps me, that is, which is the only thing that ultimately counts, is that life forms can always be convinced that they are the goodies, pure and virtuous, and that some other life form is evil and must be destroyed. That's really the most helpful handle to have if you want to create death and destruction. Oh, look, over there are some really bad people. They're not good like you and me. Why don't you go and kill them? Haven't you noticed how the so-called goodies usually end up killing just as many people as the so-called baddies? So what does it really matter if the goodies win, so long as there's lots of destruction? So long as you get something like the Battle of Baldy Grood or the bomb dropped on Droshiman 5? I find that's a comfort when I'm feeling a bit depressed, to remember evil always originates in the attempt to eliminate evil in others. And the winner of the battle will always call themselves goodies anyway, by definition. So I find there's a big area there that I can really exploit. Another area is the whole thing of unintended consequences. People can start out, oh, so confident with all kinds of good intentions, but they just don't think of the terrible side effects. But I mustn't give away all my secrets. I don't want people aware of what I'm doing when I hypnotize them. What sort of resistance might that set up? So I'd better stop. But I hope you're still pleased to hear from me. I hope you're relaxed now. Anyway, that's enough about me. I'm here to tell you a story, so I'll tell you a story about me. I think you'll find it edifying, as I'm quite the most intelligent creature the universe has ever produced. Don't dare to think of any other that may be in your mind. His reputation is altogether overrated, as hers will be in a future time you haven't yet seen. You must, and will, think more about me. You will listen. If you're lucky, you may find yourself with a small part in my story. You know about earworms, don't you? You listen to something over and over till you can't get it out of your head. Well, if you listen to my story, you may have that sensation. I like the word earworm, don't you? Implies some vile little creature crawling deep into your ear. Can you feel it now? So, what story shall I tell you? There are lots of stories I could tell. There was the time I was a master chef. That was fun. Poisoned no end of people. Meat was my speciality. I enjoy the way different species of animal like to eat each other, especially in fine restaurants. Or the time I gave masterclasses in music. Wonderful music. Burnt people's ears off when they heard it. But all that is so small scale. No, I'll tell you this story because I'm in a sound studio now, and it's about a previous time that I was here. It might give you an insight into the brilliant way my mind works. It started when I saw an opportunity to take control, as you do, of a large planet in the Alpha Centauri system. It seemed a worthwhile enterprise, as the planet had quite a large imperial spread, and I saw the opportunity to take over a whole lot of other planets in the same system at the same time. This planet, Glox, would have pleased the horrible David Attenborough. Known to its rulers as the Pink Planet because of the colour of its skies and seas, it was rich and diverse, with billions of species of plants and animals. One of the reasons for this was that there were five different sexes of most things who all chased each other about in circles, and though only two of the sexes were capable of reproducing, a lot of fun was had by all along the way. It was altogether an infuriatingly happy place to be. The only advantage to me on Glox was that the ruling elite, an almost humanoid form, had become a little complacent. They hadn't had many rebellions or wars, and the empire was relatively peaceful, the ecology relatively well balanced. They were even quite tolerant of the appearance of strangers. Even my shriveled, cadaverous form did not disgust them, and I was able to be almost as charming, urbane, and handsome to them as I always am to myself. The Glox would even include me in their selfies. I decided to take the long view of their civilization and take my time to master it, rule it, and ultimately to destroy it. As they say, it's the journey that counts. To travel is better than to arrive. Well, almost. There's certainly a lot to be said for the pleasure of anticipation. Except when it comes to one of the Doctor's appearances, of course. But I'm not anticipating that now. He wouldn't dare, would he? I arrived, by chance, very close to the Gloxian equivalent of a media centre in the middle of their major city, and decided to disguise my TARDIS as a recording booth. You may not be altogether familiar with sound studios, so I should take a moment to describe them. In this studio now, there are rows of little soundproof booths with windows so that each person recording can see the others in their little booths through the glass, though they can only hear them through the earphones. In this way, they can communicate with others and with the director, who sits with the recording equipment in a separate room. I simply placed my TARDIS at the end of the row of booths as an extra little cubicle, locked it, and left it there. As it turned out, I would not return to it for many years. It was safe enough with its perception filter switched on, and I knew it was a strategic place to leave it. The media centre was the place where the Gloxian elite would broadcast to the world. In their civilization, television had almost withered away. Their large ears were more developed than their eyes, and they relied on the fact that the spoken word produced far more interesting pictures in their minds than the visuals ever could. They produced much of their entertainment in these studios, but also it was the centre of the elite's control, and the president of Glox would broadcast once a month to his people, messages about how well the government were doing, mostly annoying and complacent messages about their success. I took a little while to acclimatise myself to the biodiversity of this new and colourful planet and to plan my strategy. It was such a beautiful pink planet. It made me quite itchy to destroy it. But how? I had recently become quite interested in the destructive power of ideas. It is evident that the bright ideas of one generation can feed the disasters of the next. All it needs is simplification and distortion. Let me illustrate this with the aid of your own miserable civilization. Love your neighbour in the right hands can become the Inquisition. Men should be equal can become Stalinism. Freedom can become, well, you get my meaning, simplify and distort. So I set out to undermine their big ideas and decided to infiltrate a university. Gloxford campus was the quality place to go. I just walked through the security gates. I told a little joke to the porter, reduced him to helpless laughter. Well, he was helpless, and I had reduced him. In the courtyard, I met the old dean of the college. His was the sort of body I was not interested in. He was rather a shrunken figure, especially by the time I dropped him in the recycle bin. But soon I had found the vice-chancellor of the university, and after a little persuasion, made him grant me a research facility in the university labs. We got on very well after that. The benefits, of course, of a hypnotic personality. I taught the students carefully, and soon I had a research team. The current big idea was pink sustainability. So I set out to simplify and distort it. How do you best ruin a planet? I have thought long and hard about this over many millennia. I've often gone down the industrial route. Let them make lots of stuff, dig up resources, burn the energy, poison the atmosphere, watch the system collapse. It's all very simple. The driving force is greed. The dominant species always wants to get more stuff, to possess more. But this planet posed a different problem. How do you ruin such a rich, diverse world with no industry, an agricultural Arcadia that believes in sustainability? Well, I do like a challenge. You still have to aim at the greed of the dominant species, in this case, the Glocks. I taught them they could not sustain themselves on their little sustainable world unless they ate more sustaining food. The animal most eaten at that time by the Glocks was the grompad, a medium-sized ruminant, not dissimilar in human terms to a small cow, in that it produced milk and meat for Glocksian consumption, although it also had some traces of its chicken and pig-like ancestors. For example, it had small wings which it used to flutter a few feet above the ground in the light gravity of the planet. It also had a pig-like tail. The food these grompads mainly ate was chorn, a widespread yellow grass with long wavy stems. I decided to start with the chorn, and to increase production my team invented a whole range of sprays. As I think I may have mentioned before, I am exceptionally intelligent and carry knowledge from many other star systems over millennia and was an unfailing guide to my team. It was here, incidentally, I developed my earworm technology. Anyway, my chemical and biological sprays were a huge success, and before long, chorn was spreading and taking over the whole countryside. Almost all other species died. The multicoloured flowers died, and then all the bees and insects, and eventually even the great trees of Nonnabel, until only the chorn survived. The chorn should have been grateful, But aside from the crinoids, I've yet to have a decent conversation with a plant. All this, of course, was really good for the grompads, who ate all the chorn and multiplied really fast, soon taking up all the rest of the countryside. I and my team went over to inventing antibodies and various fattening injections for the grompads. As a result, they became so large and heavy that they lost the use of their wings, and they had to be kept always on the ground in restrictive barns. I used to go and visit them and inspect their slaughterhouses. All excellent news. I don't think the grompads were quite as happy as I was about it, but that's ruminants for you. All this, of course, was really good for the glocks, who were eating nothing but roast grompad and wilted chorn, multiplying very fast as well. And I managed to convince them that all this was thoroughly pink and sustainable. About this time, my scientific discoveries in intensive food production became self-sustaining, and I decided it was time to change my profession. I'd been around for nearly a century, and the research establishment were getting a bit suspicious about my longevity. Time lords always have to be careful if they want to appear to be part of the local population. I wasn't particularly interested in becoming rich, but I could see where the power lay. So I moved into the corporate sector, into agribusiness. As I worked my way up to a corporate directorship, the developing situation became very interesting to me. As I say, I'd ruined other planets by industrial pollution, one sure route to destruction, but this was another way. I wondered if the two routes might go together, and that one day I might try both at once. But such a plan was for the future. At the time, it was great fun. The M-Star Corporation was doing splendidly, buying up the rights to the chorn and the grompads, and I wanted to see how far I could go. The chorn had soon taken over most of the surface of the planet, and all the other species had died. The grompads had multiplied so fast they had to be kept underground in huge multi-story pens, never seeing the light of day, trampling on their young, waiting for slaughter. All very amusing. And the glocks were growing uncontrollably, living in great cities and getting more and more obese. I saw them as fattening themselves for their own demise. And they still believed it was sustainable and pink. The power of ideas, you see. So, payoff time was approaching. The final plan was to introduce a disease. I had earlier done a lot of research into some suitable microbes that could be held in a spray, but when the time came, I didn't have to try at all. In spite of all my research, the longed-for disease manifested itself quite naturally because of the overcrowding. In a way, it was a bit of a disappointment, but I suppose I can take some credit for having developed the system in the first place. And I'm not a selfish man. If Mother Nature wishes to collaborate, I welcome her input. What happened was a terrible, beautiful collapse. The chorn got diseased and began to die. The grompads got infected and their numbers plummeted. The glocks had nothing to eat and started to starve. There were no alternative plants or animals. Everything started to fail. It was then that I became a politician. That's the place to be if you really want to ruin everything. I'd been a scientist and a businessman, and the professional politicians, who knew nothing about anything themselves, wanted someone with practical business experience, so I was called in to join the government. The crisis was so deep that I was quickly promoted. Soon I met the president of Glocks himself, whom I was destined to replace. President Torbak was decent enough for Glocks, I suppose. He had been democratically elected twice in a row. He'd risen to the top not because of any particular talent, but because he gave the impression of being nice. He also was capable of looking firm and determined, as if to say, "Don't worry, I can be relied upon to do the right thing." Of course, he hadn't an idea in his head, really, but he made the people around him feel safe, and also made them feel cleverer than they were. Sadly, I find I don't have that gift. For some reason, people around me feel neither clever nor safe. But it's not my fault that I find them incredibly stupid and I feel like destroying them. My feelings for Torbeck were no exception. I did make an effort to be his special friend, and luckily he didn't see me as a threat. On Glocks, handsome celebrities were usually elected, and he must have been confident that someone with my looks, with my difficult face, could never be elected to office, though it wasn't exactly the election route that I was planning. I've noticed that it's sometimes the quiet ones, the ones everybody underestimates, who manage to rise to the top, certainly as successfully as the ones who shout. I kept quiet and intensely loyal, and soon I was vice president, the one who has ultimate power if anything unfortunate should happen to the president. All was going to plan, as I knew it would. I do hope you're still listening. The last step in the rise to power is always the most dangerous. But I had a wonderful card up my sleeve from my time in scientific research. I think I mentioned my expertise in antibiological sprays. It was to prove most useful. The last act in my ascent to the top was to take place in these very sound studios on the occasion of the president's monthly address. It was a truly vital speech for him, and he and I were waiting together in the green room. I think I forgot to mention that every sound studio has a green room where people gather and wait before they have to record. This is where they have tea breaks or a given lunch. Some of the lunches are quite wonderful. Roast chawn flakes with grompad strips, for example. But that's another story. The day was hot. The president was anxious, and the green room was stuffy. Tarbak was nervous because the crisis had become acute over the past few weeks, and he had to make a speech in an hour's time to calm the population. Many of the Glocks were starving and trying to leave the cities to find food in the countryside. The president was pacing up and down the room practicing his speech. "Let me be clear about this. We are not afraid to make the tough decisions going forward. We have no alternative. We must all be in this together. We must do what we know to be right." You know the sort of thing. The trouble was, his ideas for a solution to the crisis didn't suit me at all. His policy was that we should all go on a diet and become a little thinner, which was quite impractical. Another idea he wanted to float was a plan to evacuate everybody from Glocks to another planet in the Glocksian Empire, which was nearly as impractical as it was two solar systems away, and the transport shuttles were too few and getting rather unreliable. As he paced, I was sitting on one of the sofas, starting the cryptic crossword in the Glocksian Times and simultaneously working on the speech I would give in place of his. I knew that Tarbak was a good Democrat and believed in freedom like everybody else. But when people are disappointed and angry, and they certainly were angry, they don't want freedom. They want a saviour. And I intended to be that saviour. I threw aside the completed cryptic, which never occupies me for long, and was watching my president sweat. I quietly suggested that his speech wasn't for an hour yet, and that he should sit down and relax. He got quite tetchy and accused me of not taking the situation seriously. "You don't have to make the speech," he said. Oh, I know just how serious it is for you, I said. He said, it's a matter of life and death. I readily agreed. I reminded him he had this gift for falling asleep for 10 minutes at a time and awakening refreshed, so I kindly suggested that this might help him. He hovered above the other small sofa and looked at me doubtfully. I looked directly into his eyes and said, please sit down. He immediately sat down. Then he complained the room was stuffy. I suggested some air freshener and went to take a small spray can from my briefcase. I looked again into his eyes and said, I'll make sure you're awake when the time comes. He seemed relieved. Very soon he was asleep. He always slept with his mouth wide open. Unpleasant, and as it turned out, unwise. I stood over him with the canister in my hand and sent a small spray into his mouth. Some of the life forms I had developed during my days in the agricultural science labs were very intriguing. Carried in the droplets of the spray I used was a microscopic but very destructive insect, not unlike the ticks that attack dogs on Earth. If you're of a nervous disposition, please listen more carefully now, as this may give you a heart attack. The tick enters the open mouth, attaches itself to the back of the tongue, which it devours, before moving down into the throat, destroying the vocal cords. It then seems to drop away without causing any further damage. What a delightfully apt insect to introduce into a sound studio, I had always thought, as a way of preventing an important speech. I had played with the idea of using it in the Gloxian Parliament, but knew that craven politicians might still prove useful to rubber stamp my wishes once I was president. In 10 minutes, Tarbak awoke, as I had promised. In not a little pain, and quite unable to speak. I showed as much concern as I could, and called in his security staff, who had been standing outside the doors of the green room, guarding the president with their usual single-minded devotion to his safety. Tarbak was yelping and pointing urgently at me, and we all agreed that it could only mean that he wanted me to give the presidential address in his place. He was carried off in an ambulance, making inarticulate noises. He never was able to explain what had happened to him. Incidentally, I didn't altogether abandon him afterwards. I kept an eye on him in hospital to make sure he stayed there. After all, we'd been good friends. It was sad, because he'd always given such long speeches in the past, but now you really couldn't carry on a decent conversation with him. It was just a lot of furious pointing. But I was loyal to the end. When he died, I gave him a very impressive funeral. But I gave an even more impressive speech that day in his place. I began by announcing the unfortunate incapacity of the president, who simply had no way of expressing how much he loved his people. I went on to explain that because of the severity of the crisis, he had decided that all freedoms would have to be temporarily suspended. Now, in his place, I would reluctantly have to take dictatorial powers, and all the glocks from the highest in the elite to the lowest orders would have to become effectually my slaves until the crisis was over. It never was quite over, of course, and I have happily ruled the Gloxian Empire for several centuries. To keep a hold on it, I had to call up all the surviving Glocks into the army. Some remained on this planet as my bodyguard, some I sent out into the Empire to commit suicide in the endless war so necessary to keep the peace. To think that it all started here. You can see why I've always had a soft spot for these studios. Did I mention the excellent lunches? And here I am again, centuries later, talking to you, making this recording to share with you as my epitaph on this beautiful planet. Well, admittedly, it's not as beautiful as it was. There are only 3 species left, all the others have died out. There is still a little chorn in the fields, though the soil is exhausted, and however many of my chemicals you pump into it, it seems to yield less and less each year. The rivers are running red with chemicals. Pretty colour. There are still a few grompads in their underground pens, but fewer of them because most have starved through lack of chorn, and there are still some Glock soldiers, but fewer of them because most have died in battle. All the other species have long gone, and the sky is a darker pink, and the empire of planets can only be held together by ruthless repression, which is fine by me. But all good things come to an end, and I think it's time to move on soon. I'm getting bored and need a new challenge. At least I've kept you interested in my story, and all the time the earworm has been working its magic. Talking of invasive creatures, I might release that interesting throat tick before I leave this planet. That would leave everybody speechless, with admiration for me, one would suppose, though I shall never know for certain. If you'll excuse me, I'll take a short break, as I'm feeling a little tired. You will wait till I return. Can you believe this? I went into the green room only to find the doctor sitting there. Cool as one of your cucumbers, that wretched scarf everywhere, holding forth to a bunch of admirers, while at the same time finishing the Gloxian Times cryptic. Show off. I tried to use the spray from my briefcase, but after a short struggle he wrestled it from me. He thinks he's got me cornered now, trapped in a small sound studio booth. I can see him, pacing about outside, playing with his sonic screwdriver. Now he's mouthing something at me triumphantly. Big mouth. He doesn't realize I'm quite safe and snug in my sound studio TARDIS and almost ready to go. Fooled you again, Doctor. But before I go, I want you to listen carefully. No time now to take your body. Now I've a different use for you as a decoy. Remember the earworm? Do you feel a slight warmth as it wriggles in your ear, and perhaps a slight humming? Now, some of you may be able to resist, but there will always be one sucker who can't, like winning the lottery in reverse. Can you tell if it's you? Can you really? My earworm is a very useful time transmitter which can transport your essence to my location. It just requires you to concentrate for a moment and visualize the inside of my TARDIS. The console, the walls. You see, there it is. Can you see that big mirror over there with the ornate gold surround? Of course you can. Now, go over and look at yourself in the mirror. Did you realize you had become that shriveled black replica of myself? Oh, didn't you? Oh, I'm so sorry. There's no point in protesting. You chose to listen. Now turn, and you can see the doors of my TARDIS. I thought so. Now, out you go to meet the doctor. You know you've always wanted to. Security will almost certainly kill you, but you won't mind, will you? All in a good cause. While he's distracted, I shall be able to escape. For those of you still listening, I'm not sure if that sacrifice was entirely necessary, but it's all gratuitous fun, don't you think? So, I'll be off. Goodbye, Doctor. Goodbye. I won't go back to the beginning of this adventure, but you could, if you like. It's only a form of time travel. As time replays itself through this recording, you may be the chosen one next time. The lucky lottery winner who gets to meet the doctor. And please don't harbour any thoughts of pitching your will against mine. You can't escape. You will listen again. For I am the master, and you will obey.